Hi, Suva. How are you?
I'm fine. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. So I didn't expect you both to be young. I thought everyone at Greenham was my age now.
Well, I mean, me and Faye weren't at Greenham, so
no.
I've only been working on the project for about 2 months, and I'm basically just helping with the interviews and getting them ready to be uploaded onto the internet and working on like the archive material. So yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Dedication, especially if you weren't there.
I'm finding it really interesting because most of the time I'm just listening to the interviews and there's so many interesting ones. And
well, mine's not very interesting because I never actually lived there. I only visited once. I was surprised Faye wanted to interview me.
I mean, that doesn't mean it won't be interesting. Some of them are really interesting, just hearing about the other things that you've done and sort of the connections that and what made you interested in even going to Greenham in the first place?
Well, actually, I was invited as part of a group. Mm-hmm. I was in a group called Prana. We started at the beginning of the 80s and we went on into the 90s, and our thing was chanting. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we had instruments as well, drums, but mainly it was about quite simple chants. And mostly, I mean, what was different when we went to Greenham with our chants is up until that point in time, most of the public chanting was protest stuff, you know, like "we shall overcome" stuff. But the chants that we were doing were much more kind of earth-based and life-affirming.
Mm.
And I mean, now everybody sings the chants that we were singing, but at that time, the sort of chants we were singing were mostly confined to religious groups or what these days would be called environmental groups, because they were about, you know, the earth is our mother and those sort of chants that have gone, you know, into the public domain, but they weren't at the beginning of the 80s.
Yeah. And how did you get into doing that?
Oh, gosh. Well, right at the beginning of the 80s, I got involved with a therapy called rebirthing, a breathing technique.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a closed group for a year, meeting once a month.
Mm-hmm.
And in that group, we started chanting.
Mm-hmm.
Some people, we had a different leader every month. Mm-hmm. And quite a few of them came from the States, and they brought some of these chants, Native American chants, that we'd never heard before, although we had an interest in Native mm-hmm. American stuff. Mm-hmm. And at the end of that year, we just carried on meeting to chant, and it just kind of grew organically.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had quite a few chants. Actually, the first public airing of our chants was at Greenham.
Oh, really?
Yes.
And how did it sort of go down at Greenham?
Very well, actually.
Mm.
It was called the March event, I think. Mm-hmm. Was it?
Was it an Embrace the Bass, or have I made that up?
Yes. You might have made it up, but basically that covers it, because it was the first time that they decided to get as many people to hold hands around the whole base, which I think is about 9 miles, isn't it? Something like that.
Yes.
And we managed it. There were enough people to hold hands right around the base.
Mm-hmm.
And we were invited to come to one of the gates. I think there were 5 gates.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of hold the energy at that gate.
Mm.
And so we went and we took the chance with us. And at that time, we only had 5. So we just repeated them. And it was, the thing that touched me is that the police, because there was police presence, but they were very benign. They were kind of jigging about to the chance.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, they said, at least we learned some new chants today. And I think they, you know, they touched something deeper,
mm-hmm.
About the connectedness to the earth and protecting the earth rather than just fight, fight, fight. You know, both are important. But up to that point, it had been more focused on "we shall overcome" sort of stuff.
Yeah, that's 'cause I mean, the narrative of Greenham often, I mean, obviously it was about nuclear weapons and war and things and about women's empowerment, but something people are picking up on now is that sort of connection to environmentalism, but people sort of are saying it wasn't articulated in that way at the time.
No, we didn't have the vocabulary. I mean, we could have had, obviously, but I mean, blimey, it was the time of protest all over the, you know, all over the Western world, really.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say the beginning of, but it was like, shit, there's shit happening. We better do something to stop it. So it was the beginning of that kind of protest, I think.
Mm.
That kind of awareness of the threat that we were under and continue to be under in one form or another.
So do you feel that the form that that threat is taking is kind of morphed or changed or?
Oh, continuously, wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
I mean, at the moment, it's just about everything.
Yeah.
Really, I mean, I don't know how much you want to get into philosophy about all this, but I think, you know, I kind of grew up in the 60s and then in the 70s, we started waking up to what was going on, and we didn't know what form it would take, but we kind of foresaw that there was going to be, we couldn't go on like this, there was going to be a crisis. And now we're in the middle of it, and, you know, COVID's just a name for it.
Mm.
But COVID, to my mind, and I don't want to go into all the politics of that, I'm sure you had plenty of that, but to my mind, it's just a... what would we say? It's a make or break time that's in the guise of some harmless little virus, to my mind. I've had it and it was no big deal, but certainly the, it's hard not to talk about COVID, isn't it? It's just the sort of smokescreen, really, behind which all the other stuff is coming out and all the other stuff needs to come out. And I think that's been the gift of COVID.
Mm.
It's made people look at all the other stuff that's going on, far, far more serious than COVID itself.
Mm.
And we foresaw that. We didn't foresee a virus, but we foresaw some kind of cataclysmic end to the way we were living. It couldn't go on. Mm. We were the last people to really, the last generation to really, I don't know, love the earth the way it's been. And work with it, work with nature, work with it, and learn from it and merge into it. It's very hard these days, I think.
Mm.
I never wanted to visit the countryside, you know, I wanted to live in it.
Yeah.
Work with it, know it, get my hands dirty. And that kind of came, you know, the chants brought that as well.
Mm.
They were very simple. We started, as I said, we started with American Indian chants, and then we all got teepees and we lived in teepees. And if you live in a teepee, you learn a lot.
Yeah. Where did you live in a teepee?
We were living in West Wales by then. Sorry, I just need to plug the charger in. We were living in West Wales. And there was a place that was cheap at that time. And we were able to get, well, we'd start with lets and then eventually find places to buy.
Mm. So is that kind of what your life looked like at the time when you went to Greenham? So what did your life look like around 1982?
Well, I was actually living in a shared house. It was a mansion, smallish mansion. Mm. And three of the families that were in Prana were living there together.
Yeah.
Beautiful place, beautiful grounds, a lake, and, you know, we were just renting, but it was beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, also that was what was easy then. You could live on the dole. We were all on the dole. And so we were just making music a lot of the time. And after Greenham, we recorded the first, I mean, it was cassettes in those days.
Mm-hmm.
We recorded our first cassette.
And when you went to Greenham, was there Why do you think you only went for one day? Did you not feel drawn to stay for longer?
I had three young children.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Wasn't the time, really.
Yeah. So,
but, you know, I was always with them in spirit.
Yeah.
And a lot of people I knew lived there. And, you know, to this day, that's a bond.
Mm.
I'm sure you're finding that.
Mm.
And later on, I got into, when I was still in Wales, I got into running groups, and I was running women's groups. And a lot of the women had been at Greenham, and I could see what a bonding process and, like you say, an empowerment of women that had been.
Mm.
And a toughening. I mean, those women were bloody tough.
Yeah.
Imagine living in bin liners through the winter. I mean, it's hard to imagine.
Yeah. It's, well, when I don't know how much you know about Greenham, but one thing that comes up a lot is the daily evictions that started happening in about 83 or something, where every day, sometimes more than once a day, they'd come and grab as much of your stuff as you can. So everyone just ended up living under tarps.
Yeah.
I mean, that is resilient.
I know, through the winter. It's okay. Well, it's okay-ish in the summer, but
yeah. But you just wonder as well, wouldn't you feel, what do you do? What? but I suppose you're just constantly resetting up the camp. But
well, making fires, scratching wood together to make fires, and
yeah.
I mean, it was an incredible bonding process, wasn't it? Because they had to just love each other and hold each other.
And do you think part of the importance was that it was women only for the majority?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely, because however highly trained men are, you can't train out of them how, I mean, in some ways there's no respect, but how to respect women. I think it's hard for a man to be brutal to a woman,
mm-hmm.
in a sort of public neutral. I mean, men beat up their wives all the time, but in a public eye, I don't know if you know what I'm saying. I'm not finding my words very well, but it was absolutely vital that it was women.
Mm.
And I don't think it had ever been done before. And I think it just completely confounded the men.
And you said earlier that you sort of think of the 80s as the time of protest. Was there other sort of movements that you were involved in? Or protests that you went to?
No, I'm not an activist in that way.
Mm.
You know, you could call me a coward, but I always had reasons. You know, I had kids at home, and I'd started to get it, and you know, from the beginning of the 80s with the rebirthing, I was starting to get into another more spiritual approach to change.
Mm.
Oh yes, because to go back a bit, when I was, let's see, 68, 69, 70, I was working as an architect in London. And at that time, I was in Notting Hill, and at that time they were building a bypass through Notting Hill. It was called Westway. It's still there.
Yeah.
It's elevated above the top of Notting Hill. And certainly Notting Hill, North Kensington, South Kensington was already posh, but North Kensington was still very working class, and there were lots of people who'd grown up there. You know, there was a real sense of community there. Mm-hmm. And they started protesting against this road that was going to, well, decimate the community, really. They were all being rehoused in different suburbs mm-hmm. of London. Mm-hmm. And I joined that protest.
Mm-hmm.
The protest was to just sit in the road so that the vehicles couldn't build it or drive on it once it was opened. So it was strange because I was working as an architect doing work for local council in the daytime and then fighting it at night. And I got very, very angry. I mean, this is my sort of spiritual truth, really. I got very, very angry and bitter. And I thought, this isn't going to serve anybody coming from anger and bitterness. I need to find another way. And I think when I discovered rebirthing and spirituality, I just, that was the way I went.
Would you be able to explain a bit more about what rebirthing is, or what that kind of means?
Okay, it's a very simple breathing technique of continuous breathing and letting go with a sigh on the exhale. And you do it kind of lying down with your eyes closed with a rebirther sitting beside you. But it takes you into your subconscious. You do that kind of breathing steadily for about an hour. A lot of memories come up. Sometimes even past life stuff comes up, but certainly from this life, and traumas. And the rebirther's job is to just not comment, but to sit there and hold you, not physically, but hold you in love. It was the beginning of my spiritual awakening, I suppose.
So that came before you getting into chanting. That was,
well, the chanting resulted from that first 1 year group from that we were rebirthing in. And it was a fairly new, it originated in America, and it was a fairly new therapy in Britain. So we were getting these different leaders coming from the States who brought the chants.
And you sort of mentioned a few things sort of originating in America. Did a lot of it come from sort of other cultures, or, because I suppose,
certainly the American Indian stuff.
Yeah.
It's still American, but those were the first chants we learned. There was an American Indian teacher called Sun Bear. And we did meet him eventually, but the chants came from him.
Yeah.
Wow. Or his
And are you aware of a sort of history of chanting and things in the UK, like before the time that you're speaking about? Because you're talking about sort of ancient practices of Native Americans. And
well, there was the chanting, you know, the Greenham chanting. There was the chanting that came through the protest movement. I call it the We Shall Overcome. You know, there was a lot of that coming from America as well, you know, from the anti-Vietnam protests and the anti-racism protests that were going on in America. I mean, I was actually in America when I was a student in the 60s.
Oh, wow.
When there were the first race riots in America. So there were, you know, the idea of chanting wasn't new. But the idea of spiritual chanting, all we knew of was, you know, monks and nuns and Gregorians, and all behind doors. It wasn't out in the public domain at that point.
Yeah.
And we felt, because we got so much from them, we felt we need to put this out, you know. So we made 6 cassettes in all. And we started going to camps and festivals, and Glastonbury Festival we went to every year, and just getting people to chant together. It's not about performance. It's about what happens when you sing together. Something happens. And then by the end of the 80s, we would go to a festival or a camp of some kind, and you know, we'd arrive and there'd already be people sitting around fires singing our chants. And we thought, okay, well, we've done the work that we wanted to do.
Yeah.
To spread the chants. And then, of course, some of the chants that were recorded came from Greenham. You know, they started, obviously, in Greenham, they started coming up with lots of beautiful chants. So it was a sort of reciprocal thing, really, by then.
Do you remember any of the chants that you first took to Greenham?
Yeah, sure. They're all on our first cassette. I am a circle, I am healing you. Do you know that one?
No.
All the earth is sacred. The earth is our mother. Tall trees.
Mm-hmm.
I'd have to check, but those are some of them.
Well, that's a good memory. And the group Prana, was that all women or was it mixed?
No, it was mixed.
It was mixed. Yeah. Were you ever part of an all female chanting group?
No.
Yeah. And did that not feel important to be?
Well, as I say, I was running women's groups with another woman. So there was plenty of chanting with just women. But I never formed an all-women band or anything like that, no.
And at the time, do you think there was more sort of women interested in that kind of thing, or was it quite balanced, really?
I would say there's always been more women interested in self-inquiry and spirituality. But the Native American stuff actually did attract as many men as women, because there's a kind of, I mean, don't get me wrong, but there is a kind of macho element to American Indian, you know, burying yourself in the ground, and some of the rituals appeal to the more macho side, and the sweat lodge and all of that stuff. So in that regard, it was always quite well balanced. But when I started working just with women, I certainly felt a different energy, and just coming home in a way.
Yeah. Sort of going back to the day you spent at Greenham, you mentioned the gates. Do you remember what gate you were at?
No, to be honest.
No. Is there anything you sort of remember about the day and sort of what you saw and how it felt and the people that you were with? Or everyone that was there, did it feel like it was very busy? Did it feel...
Oh, it was certainly busy. There was a lot of joy there. Just the fact of that many people being together with such a... can't find the right adjective, but with such an amazing purpose. And I'd never imagined anything like that.
Yeah.
Not that many people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a few years later I was part of something on a much smaller scale, which was to circle Stonehenge after they put the boundaries up.
Oh really?
Yes. But I won't digress with that. I mean, it was a very strange day for me because I was going through a huge personal trauma.
Mm-hmm.
The father of my kids was leaving me at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So that would have coloured my perception of the day, but probably deepened it as well, because I was so raw that day.
Yeah. And... In terms of the women's movement, do you feel things have progressed much or changed much for women across your lifetime?
I would say yes, of course. I've seen a kind of progression from the feminist movement that was very angry,
mm-hmm.
and very anti, of which Greenham was a part. But I think Greenham was also a turning point. It included that angry solidarity protest, but through the experience they went through, it moved into something much more spiritual. The kind of bonding of women discovering each other. Because I grew up without I grew up with brothers, and then I did architecture, which was mainly men. Mm-hmm. I didn't really discover what it was to be a woman until my mid-20s, mm-hmm. when I started meeting, you know, women on the same wavelength as me. And I think Greenham was a huge turning point in that. Women discovering each other.
Mm.
Just the women I've met since, especially when I was running women's groups, and the women that came from Greenham, I could feel this sisterhood that I'd never felt, I had no awareness of growing up,
mm.
which is now in the common, you know, common domain, I would say.
Mm.
Now maybe you take it for granted, but it was certainly something new that came a lot from Greenham, I think.
Mm.
That turning point, I think.
Yeah, so, I mean, and could you explain or try and explain why you think it's important that Greenham is sort of remembered? And how it can be useful to subsequent generations.
Maybe that's more your task. it was a key point of evolution, I would say.
Mm.
Evolution of, I mean, this is sounding very grand, isn't it? But a key point in the evolution of humanity.
Mm.
Because it was on such a huge scale, and the fact that it was successful, I mean, that was extraordinary that it was successful.
Yeah.
Because of the sheer determination and resilience of extraordinary women who put their lives on aside to do something that, you're going to have me in tears in a minute. I mean, it was extraordinary.
Yeah. And I mean, amazingly extraordinary that they actually took the weapons away. And
yeah. Also,
the land has been restored to common land. Do you know much about, well, obviously it's called Greenham Common, and so it was part of the common land and then got turned into a base. And I think it was maybe in about 2000 that it's now, so you can now go walk around it and it's
beautiful.
Back. And I mean,
beautiful. I think it's hugely important. It's so amazing you're doing this project.
Mm.
I mean, I've got friends, you know, in their 40s, and I say something about Greenham Common, they've never heard of it, you know, and I can't believe that people in their 40s haven't heard of it. You know, they didn't hear of it from their parents.
Mm. And I suppose I can think of, yeah, I mean, I think, when I first heard about it, I mentioned it to my mum, and then she said something like, oh yeah, I think your grandma used to take sandwiches down.
Oh, great.
and that's quite funny, thinking of my Catholic grandmother taking part in something quite subversive in some kind of a way. But that's why it's really interesting to interview everyone that had a connection with there, because there are all these sort of satellite groups that were sort of support groups and doing things in their own, so in their own sort of areas. And so actually sort of spending time at the camp is like one part of it, but that's one part of the movement. It's sort of goes much wider than that, and we want to be able to find out about all those stories and sort of how all these different women's initiatives were linked at the time. So, I mean, I think what you've got to say is really interesting, because I've not come across anyone sort of talking about it as this sort of spiritual aspect that is interlinked with it. A lot of it is, I mean, wonderful stuff, but a lot more sort of, I don't know, I'm trying to think of, like, heard about stuff to do with like the miners' strike and the link to do with that, and the link to do with then taking aid convoys around the world, and well, just so many things.
Well, I think women learn to women learnt to love each other
in
a way that was new. I mean, we grew up believing we could only love men, you know, and we could only be physical with men. And I'm not even talking about lesbianism, I'm just talking about women. I mean, my fantasy when I was a little girl, I was a lonely little girl, was to be in a, like a puppy in a pile of puppies. I wanted that kind of physical affirmation of warmth. And and after Greenham, women learned that they could do that with each other, and it didn't have to be sexual. It was just a natural expression of being an animal, for God's sake, you know. It's a basic natural yearning, and I call that as spiritual as anything else, you know, that yearning to come home to who we truly are, who we're programmed to be before we're born. We're programmed to be held and loved, and by and large we're not in that way. And then, I mean, it wasn't just Greenham, but it was around that time that, certainly for me, I discovered women are not a subspecies to, you know, they're not subspecies to men. And I don't know, I went to an all-girls school and I didn't like the girls very much. It was very competitive and a bit nasty to each other. And I didn't know women could be beautiful. Isn't it ridiculous? But that's the environment I grew up in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. And sort of thinking about how you're saying you've lived off the land for a long time, and then trying to pick up on the fact that Greenham was also like a land rights issue, and about sort of land being not accessible. Throughout your life, have you felt sort of prevented from having access to the land in the way that you need it by, or do you have anything to say about sort of the way that land is cordoned off from us?
In principle, of course, but it hasn't been my life experience. I've been very lucky to be able to live on the land as and when I've chosen to. So I don't have a direct experience of that, but I think it was just as important that the women slept on the land, because that wouldn't have happened for so many women otherwise. And brutal though it was, I mentioned earlier that I'd spent a lot of time in teepees, and I learned so much just living on the earth and experiencing the elements much more directly. And we have, you know, we have that tendency to go towards comfort. And there was no comfort at Greenham. The only comfort was in each other and what they were doing. There was, well, apart from some nice sunny days in the summer, there was no physical comfort. But I think until you're made to experience that, you don't really connect with the earth directly. So honestly, I think that was just as important as getting rid of cruise missiles. And maybe the women who are at Greenham wouldn't agree with me on that, but that's been my experience in life. Until I'm forced to really connect with nature, I don't. So I've put myself in positions where I have to. And, you know, just, I wash nappies in running rivers, you know, and it's, when I look back on it, I think, why was I so hard on myself? Why didn't I get a washing machine? But I'm really grateful I did that. There's really, you get into a very different rhythm. Mm-hmm. You get into a natural rhythm. Okay, it's going to take me a couple of hours to wash all these nappies, mm-hmm. but I'm standing in the river, and I'm, you know, I'm not saying I did that all the time. I had a house mm-hmm. a lot of the time. But I remember the first women's camp we ran. There was a young woman there from London, and she'd never had any contact with fire. She'd never lit a fire. The closest she got would be to turning the gas on and striking a match.
Mm.
And so that was a week long, that camp. We gave her the job of lighting the fire every day, and we gave her the name Firelighter. And you know, I could see how much that small thing could change somebody's life.
Mm.
And that was on a much, that was on a huge scale at Greenham, that mm. connecting. And the seasons, you know, the seasons and the weather, the changing weather and the changing sky, and you don't get to see that when you live in a house, not really. That, to my mind, is as major a turning point as the whole protest aspect.
Yeah.
Which was, you know, I'm not belittling that. It's phenomenal what they achieved. Don't get me wrong. It's phenomenal. They got rid of fucking American military, you know.
Yeah.
And they died for it. There was a young woman. Now, tears do come to my eyes. There was a young woman I knew in my local town. She died. She was run over by a vehicle at Greenham. I don't know how many people actually died, but she did. And I didn't know her personally, but I knew her by sight. You know, her father had the sports shop in town. I knew.
So sort of speaking more broadly, for instance, the women's circles and the women's camps that you've run, do you have any comments about those?
Well, I loved them. They were wonderful. As I say, I was discovering womanhood myself.
Mm.
And certainly in the 80s when I started, there was that thread that was coming from Greenham. Mm. And I could feel the connectedness of the women who'd been at Greenham, even if they hadn't been there at the same time as each other. I mean, I've been in a group recently. I left a couple of years ago, but I was in a very strong group of people where it was a married couple running it, and she started it by running a women's group.
Mm-hmm.
And then this was about 12, 13 years ago. She was running a women's group, and then he started running a men's group.
Mm.
And then eventually we started meeting together, and it was amazing. It was something I'd always wanted to happen, because in the women's group, we were looking at women's conditioning
mm.
and men's privilege. And with these two groups, you know, brother and sister groups coming together, it was very much, how can we work together?
Mm.
And how has men's privilege affected women's sense of inferiority and just getting very vulnerable about that, and realizing that women had colluded in men's superiority, and to fight it as the early feminists did is only reinforcing it in some way. We had to come about it a different way. So the women worked a lot on, I mean, we had one retreat where we were all sharing the abuse we'd suffered in different ways from men's privilege. And, you know, there were some heart-rending stories, and there were some what you might call insignificant stories, but they all fitted together to see how we'd colluded in the myth of being inferior.
Mm-hmm.
And then we started going to the men's group and talking to them about their privilege, and they just couldn't get it. You know, it's like when you're white, there's no way you can get what it feels like to be black. and to feel how privileged you are. You can know it in your head, but you can't really, you can't possibly know it in your being. So it took quite a long time for the men to, I mean, it was a good bunch of men, so they were willing to listen. And, you know, eventually they started to get it, and they started to say, we had no idea, you know, we're really sorry. And these are good men, you know, these are aware men. And still, I mean, I have it with my own partner. He still doesn't really get it. How can he, you know, because he's a man. How can he get, you know, the simple things of we don't feel safe walking down a dark street at night, you know, simple things, but also the much more subtle things of how, I mean, I've got a good man, but there's subtle things where he just speaks from his privilege and he doesn't hear it, you know. So that's what I would say has changed so much since Greenham days, the coming together of the genders to fight on the same side, you know, not to fight each other.
Yeah. And you sort of, you said about how the groups met, the men's and the women's groups met separately before they came together. Do you think that time meeting separately is important? And also, yeah. And you're talking about the sort of anger of the early feminist movement or 70s, 80s. Do you think that anger was like an important stage?
Yeah, it was important and it was totally understandable. When you first find out about this, bloody hell, you're angry.
Yeah.
But then I think then it came to be seen that the anger, you know, what you fight, you reinforce in some way. Mm-hmm. And it had to be done a different way.
Mm-hmm.
And these things, you know, you can look back and say this, this and this, but it's an organic unfolding of waking up, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah. And
I don't make any of it wrong. I don't make the anger wrong or the protest wrong. Mm-hmm. I just love the way it's evolving.
Mm.
Yeah.
And in your initial sort of email, you mentioned an anecdote about your friend who was a pilot.
Yeah.
Would you be able to tell that story?
Yeah. It's a lovely story, actually. He worked for British Airways and he was very sympathetic towards Greenham, but of course he couldn't go there.
Yeah.
And I think he was on a flight to, I think it was Kenya or somewhere, and he stocked up with a great crate of tropical fruit to take to the women at Greenham, but he knew he couldn't, you know, he knew that it would be difficult to go there. And actually he landed at Heathrow quite early in the morning, so he didn't even change out of his uniform. So he went with his uniform, with this big crate of fruit for the women, and it was early and there was only one woman up. And of course she bristled when she saw the uniform, you know, who's this man? What's he doing here? And I don't know if she said anything to him, but she had to change her tune when she saw what he brought them. And of course he was chuffed. But the beautiful thing was, I was telling this story a couple of years ago at a funeral of a woman I'd been caring for. And there was a group of us carers sitting together at the table after the funeral, and I told this story, and I noticed one of the women had gone quiet and gone quite white, and I said, what's going on? She said, I was that woman.
It's an amazing bit of what was the word, serendipity.
I know, out of however billion women there are in the world, that
we met
years later. And I mean, unfortunately, my friend, he wasn't a pilot, he was a flight engineer, he died because he would have been so tickled by that story. You know, the completion of the story.
Yeah, that was amazing.
Yeah, and I think there were a lot of men like him that supported in the best way they could whilst respecting it was a women only place.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for speaking
to you too, Josie. Lovely to meet you.
Yes, you too.